Woman, how divine your mission. Here upon our natal sod. Keep, oh, keep the young heart open, always to the breath of God. All true trophies of the ages are from mother love impearled, for the hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. They say that man is mighty, he governs land and sea, he wields a mighty scepter or lesser powers than he. But a mightier power and stronger man from his throne has hurled, for the hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. Written by William Ross Wallace in 1865. What was going on in our nation in 1865? We were drawing to the end of the Civil War, a nation divided and uncertain about its future. That's when Wallace wrote this poem. And it's also when the seeds of Mother's Day were sown by the daughter of a Methodist pastor, no less, named Anna Marie Jarvis. She worked in her local church in West Virginia, Methodist Church, creating what she called mother's clubs. She saw so many young mothers in her day struggling to understand good nutrition and other skills to raise their children, so she would bring moms together. And then at the end of the Civil War, she looked for a way to promote peace, and it became her dying legacy to establish a day to honor mothers, mothers who are living as well as mothers who are dead. Her daughter Anna took up the cause after her mother's death. And in her Methodist church in Philadelphia in 1908, the first Mother's Day was recognized on the second Sunday in May. Now think about that. In a time when there's division and strife and uncertainty about the future, what did people choose to praise as a sign of hope? Mighty men of valor? Commerce? Trade? National security? No, they praise mothers. Why? Because the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Just ask the President of the United States during the Civil War. In 1861, in the month of January, Abraham Lincoln was in a heavy meeting to choose his cabinet, and in through the door came a dispatcher and handed the president a note. The president read the note, immediately adjourned the meeting, went to his room, hastily packed a bag, rushed to the train station without even a bodyguard, and began the long trip back to Illinois to get to a very remote cabin. Now, who could command that kind of response from the president? His birth mother? No, actually. Nancy Hanks Lincoln died when Abe was a little boy growing up in southern Indiana. The woman who commanded that kind of response was his stepmother, Sarah. You see, she came into Abe's life when his world had been turned upside down, when there was strife and uncertainty about his future. And I guess acting out of that grief, he became rather wild and unruly, the kind of boy many people would have said, that kid is just untrainable. But she came into his life to show him love. And even though she herself was illiterate, she could tell that Abe was smart. She made sure he had plenty of books to read. And she poured into his potential. Later on, after that last visit in 1861 to see his stepmother Sarah, Abraham Lincoln would say, "All that I am or hope to be, I owe to my angel mother." Why would he say that? Because the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Now, working mothers, rest at ease. I am not here today to make you feel guilty. that the future of our world depends on you being more available to your kids. I know plenty of working moms who dread the Mother's Day sermon. They just expect guilt to be heaped on them for not giving enough time to their kids. But you know what I've experienced with working moms? They don't need anybody's assistance in finding guilt. They deal with plenty of it themselves as they try to balance the stress between a working career and the demands of raising children and a family. So I don't think guilt helps. And I don't want to make this day harder for women who do not have children for a whole host of other reasons. Mother's Day is a very hard day. Instead, I want us to think about a society in which women had to work so hard, it was beyond the brink of what's reasonable. A society in which way too many mothers lost children because of violence. A society in which women were degraded. A society that was rampant with prejudice and fear of the outsider. A society in which its leader was handing down decrees discriminating against foreigners. In other words, I'm talking about ancient Egypt. Were you thinking of a different place? And I'm thinking about a very courageous mother named Jochebed. Now, you remember Jochebed, don't you? If you were here last Mother's Day, you should, because I preached on the same passage. And now you're saying, oh, now I remember that Jochebed. Yes, the mother of Moses. She was a Hebrew living in slavery in Egypt, raising her children with a bleak future, made even darker by the fact that Pharaoh had ordered the execution of all male babies under 2 years old. But Jochebed was not the kind of mother who took a threat sitting down. She got busy and made a basket and waterproofed it, put her child in it, sent him down the Nile River, where he was found and rescued by none other than the daughter of the man who issued that murderous decree, Pharaoh's daughter. And when she realized that this was a Hebrew baby, she had the birth mother found so that she could nurture and raise the child until he would be old enough to come and live with her. Now, all due respect to Charlton Heston and Cecil B. DeMille, they got something seriously wrong in the movie. In this scene from the movie, it would have us believe that Moses had no idea of his Hebrew identity until he was adult. But that wasn't the case. He was raised by his Hebrew mother, Jochebed. He was raised in that identity of his Hebrew faith, and then later would grow up in the world of Egypt, where he would be a prince. In other words, Moses was brought up in two worlds, and one day, one of those worlds would win out. Which one was it? The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Think for just a few moments about the two worlds of Moses. Think, for instance, about the fact that in ancient Egypt, Moses would have grown up in a society that worshiped many gods. Egyptologists say that in Moses' day, popular culture worshiped as many as 80 gods, and most of those gods took the likeness of some kind of creature. One of them was a serpent. So years later, when Moses came back to Pharaoh to say, "Let my people go," and he threw his staff on the floor and it became a serpent, and he picked it up again and it became a staff, he wasn't just doing a magic trick. What was he saying? Your gods are subject to a greater authority. So why did the people worship 80 gods in Egypt? To support their most important value in life, comfortable living, living prosperous, living well, living without any discomfort. You worship the gods to procure their favor. That's why you worship them. Now, today, we wouldn't say that we worship lots of different gods, but what are the values we have that have a way of taking the focus of our worship? Could we also be a society that says, you know what, we place a lot of high value on comfort and ease? Listen to some interesting statistics on consumerism that has come out just within the last couple of years. Now, this first one deals with women. I'm not being sexist here. Take it up with Forbes magazine. They're the ones who printed this statistic that in 1930, the average American woman owned 9 outfits. Today, the average woman owns 30, at least one for each day of the month. There are more shopping malls in the U.S. than high schools. Most homes have more televisions than people. That one really hurts for me, I gotta admit. The average American home has tripled in size in the last 50 years. And not only that, we don't have enough room to put all of our belongings in our larger houses. Do you know what one of the fastest growing industries are today? Storage places, storage units to hold all of our stuff. Now, like I say, we wouldn't say that we worship other gods, but can that drive for having things and living well enter into our faith and what we worship? For instance, if you think about your prayer life, just in the last year, what's been the majority of your focus? Has it been on petitions that have to do with your comfort and well-being? Oh God, help this house to sell. Oh God, help me get this job. Help me get this raise. Help me figure out these financial issues in my home. Or has it been about the hurting of the world? Has it been about the needs of others? I mean, it is funny that what we value has a way of becoming what we worship. Moses lived in that kind of world, but you know what other kind of world he lived in? A world that taught him from infancy that he is a child of the Most High God, created in the image of that God, that he is loved and valued, and that God stands for justice in the world, stands for peace, and God carries out God's will through people just like Moses. Moses also grew up in a world where sex was worshiped. Sex. People who were committed to living comfortably, living well, believed that self-indulgence, gratification, is a right of every person. So sexuality was very big. And in a society where women were second-class citizens, a man of power would look at a woman as simply an object for his gratification. Imagine what a person like Moses in his position could have thought of women and what he had the right to do. But Moses was also raised in another world that placed a high value on family and relationships, that taught that those relationships are sacred. You know, we've seen some positive trends in teenage sexuality in the last 20 years, that teenagers who say they're sexually active is decreasing a little bit, but at the same time, statistics show that right now, about 50% of high school students say that they have been sexually active. When Moses wrote the Mosaic Code, and all of these laws of sexual ethics are in books of Leviticus and Exodus, they're in there to say that this is an important value for this community formed in the image of this great God we worship. These laws and ethics, they're not to be definitions on human sexuality. What they're meant to say is that God values relationships of fidelity. God values the family and the respect and the honor and the treatment of each other. This is important to God. And life goes well when we live with this value. And so another obvious characteristic of Moses' world is that he grew up in a culture that said slavery is okay. He grew up in a culture that said it's not only okay, it's necessary to exploit some people in order for other people to have privilege. And this was a tension that would one day blow up for Moses. Because as a child, as a teenager, as a young adult, he had to live with the painful reality that it was his people being exploited for his benefit. Because he was raised in his Hebrew identity. And one day that tension cracked for him. Out walking, he saw an Egyptian soldier beating a Hebrew slave, and he snapped, and that inner world exploded out of Moses. He struck the soldier. He forever made public his real identity, his real world, and it changed history. You know, as parents, it's just natural for us to want to raise our children so they don't struggle. And when you see your kids struggling, it's hard, isn't it? We want to raise our children so that they'll have peace, they'll be comfortable, but I wonder if sometimes we do them a disservice. That we should raise children who will grow up and they will have certain struggles when they live in a world where there's injustice and not every person is treated the same, that they'll struggle with that. That they will struggle with some people who live with benefits others don't have. That they will struggle with an idea that their sex appeal is their only appeal. That they'll say, no, there's an inner world that disagrees with that reality. I don't want mothers who are already stressed out to feel guilt that the raising of our children to change this world the way God would have it is up to them alone. But I would say this, moms, please know that every time you pour spiritual influence into your children, God will use it. Moms, do you ever get frustrated that what you're doing with your kids isn't making a difference? You go through everything you go through to get them here on church this Sunday, and you're doing it for children who act like they don't want to be here anyway. I have to go back there again. Mom, why do you make me do this? And you just want to stop and turn the car around and go home and say it's not worth it. Don't rush to judgment. Even when you can't see it, God is planting a seed. Studies have shown that when kids wander away from the faith, it's not because we didn't give them enough time or we didn't put them through enough rituals. Kendra Creasy Dean, a professor at Harvard, says in her book, Almost Christian, it's because sometimes we practice what she calls moral therapeutic deism. We simply want to impart to kids that living a comfortable life and being a good person is really all that God expects of us. And we haven't shown them that this faith in God really matters. So when life isn't so comfortable, in fact, when life is downright hard and you're living in slavery, you can still turn to that God as a vital force when you impart to kids that we actually believe this stuff. It puts something in them God will use. And for those of us who can't be mothers, and I put myself in that category, no matter what, I can't be a mother. We have to know that God needs more than birth mothers to rock the hands of cradles. God needs people like a Sarah Lincoln who would take another child and pour her life into that child because she believed in that child's potential. This past Friday, I was at the commencement service at Garrett Seminary. And last Sunday, if you were here, Garrett honored my 30 years in ministry with a scholarship in my name. And I want to thank those of you who have contributed to that. It's quite an honor, and it's already over $30,000. And I want to thank you for your generosity. So this past Friday, I was at commencement service. The guest speaker was Dr. James Hilberth. Dr. James Hilberth. He is the president of Meharry Medical College in Nashville and a brilliant individual. He has more degrees than I can begin to name. A brilliant scientist, philosopher, the first African-American Rhodes Scholar from Arkansas. The first African-American in the 125-year history of Johns Hopkins Medical School to be granted a full professorship in science. Brilliant man. So, he delivers a message called, "Don't Let What You Learn Negate What You Know." Don't let what you learn negate what you know. And he talked about learning today. He had a statistic I found staggering, that 90% of the world's data right now has been created over the last 2 years. 90% of the world's data. In other words, it's a staggering rate of information coming at us. And on top of that, we live in a world where there's real news and there's fake news. And so we have to be extra discriminating about what we learn. And then he talked about what philosophers call the four levels of knowledge. There's sensory knowledge, there's experience knowledge, like when you put your hand in the fire, you get burned. Experience tells you don't do that again. There's intellectual knowledge, where you learn information, but then he says there's the learning of the heart. The learning that says, I know I love you. I can't prove it. That's more than just information. It's a knowing inside. It's a knowing that forms you and shapes you. He said, I was given a knowing as a little boy, raised in a Baptist church in Arkansas by parents and a family where faith was the centerpiece of what we did. We prayed, we went to Sunday school, we went to worship, and it just formed me with the knowledge of who I am in God. And then he said, when I was 11 years old, my dad died. He had something that should have been easily remedied, but he was refused care because he was black. And it shattered what he knew. That he knew such diseases were preventable. That he knew hospitals and doctors are supposed to live by an oath that sees everybody gets care. He started to get angry. He said, I was at a critical point entering into my teenage years, where I could have said, what good does it do to live toward my potential? But he said, I just had this knowing in my soul that God created me for a purpose and didn't want me to abandon that. So he goes to school. He becomes a learned scholar, degree after degree, learning things that would tempt him to disregard his faith. But he says, no matter what I learned, it didn't negate what I know, that I'm a child of the King. I am redeemed by a gracious and loving Savior named Jesus Christ, and it has formed my life. Don't let what you learn negate what you know. Moms, families, when we invest in the most important knowing our children can have, God will use that to change history, because the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Or maybe better yet, the world that rules the hand rules the cradle.